Welcome. Looking at the crowd, I don't think anybody's hiking because everybody's here, right? I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm going to let you just start with this. Good morning. My name is Sharon and I serve the village's education lead, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dan Spencer, professor of environmental studies at University of Montana. In his third talk, in Deep Time, is the geological story of the Pacific Northwest. Thank you, Dan.
Thanks so much, Sharon. This is a really fun talk for me to give, partly because I'm finally talking about something that I know something about. But I have to do a caution to that here. My geological education is primarily from the previous millennium. And I graduated from college in 1979 with a degree in geology. My very first time at Holden Village was the winter of 79 and 80 here. And some of you may remember a nice geological event in the Pacific Northwest in May of 1980, when Mount St. Helens erupted. And so that spring, the earthquakes were starting, some of the initial volcanic eruptions were starting. And I used to give a much racier version of this talk here. I used to do it as a geological strip tease. Because when I was here in that winter, I had all sorts of really fun geology t-shirts with me. And each one of them had they had corny slogans like Igneous is Bliss. All sorts of things like that. But they were all geological. They all made a geological point. So I used to put them all on in the appropriate order and give a talk on the geology here. And then I would strip them later off every time I got to another point. Alas, this is the only geology teacher I have with me. So you're spared that. The other thing I want to say, though, Hal Tausig, if you've been coming to his talks, what percentage of the truth does he say he talks and gives? Yeah. He's about 50% of what he says is true. So keep that in mind. I hope to be a little bit higher percentage on that, but the story I'm going to tell I think is pretty accurate in the broad picture. The more you get close down to the fine details, probably the less accurate I am to give that story anymore. It's simply because I haven't been in geology for a number of decades. But I have a wonderful book that David Christians, whom some of you may know, was up here recommending, called The Rocks Don't Lie. All right, so I might lie, but the rocks won't. And so what we're going to talk about here is kind of general interpretations on that. So I included this talk as part of the notion of deep time because actually the very concept of deep time comes largely out of the emerging field of geology the last couple hundred years. This is a really fascinating book because it's called A Geologist Investigates Noah's Flood. And we have still an ongoing cultural tension in our society between how we tell the story of the Earth. And geologists tell the story of a very ancient Earth that's about 4.5 billion years old. But that's a relatively recent discovery, really within the last 100 years, largely coming out of the possibility of doing radiometric dating to date minerals that are found in the rocks that have radioactive materials and they deteriorate over a particular predictable half-life. So if we can look at what's found in the rocks, we can get a pretty good sense of the age of those. That's really the last 100 years. Prior to that, however, the 100 years from the mid-1700s to the mid-1800s, geologists were accumulating more and more evidence that we couldn't fit the story of the Earth into a 6,000-year period, which was the accepted date for many, many years in the Western tradition, primarily by reconstructing biblical genealogies and adding all those dates together. Those were the oldest written documents that scholars had, so they reconstructed that. And so for many, many years in the Western tradition, we thought the Earth was about 6,000 years old. And the dominant geological force within that was Noah's Flood. People looked at Noah's Flood, and this was in the Bible reported as a global-wide flood. And so geologists tried to explain mountains, river valleys, all the different things we see, and particularly fossils, by Noah's Flood. A well-known geologist whose name I'm blanking on here, but he was asked to summarize for him the wonder of geology. And he, in one sentence. And his one sentence was more or less, the top of Mount Everest is limestone. Now, why did he say that was his geology? Well, because limestone forms in the oceans. It forms below sea level. It's where we get our fossils. And yet the highest point on Earth is a rock that formed below sea level, full of fossils there. And so so the geologists try to wrap out what happens to get fossils forming below the sea level up to the highest point of the Earth. And that's sort of what we're looking at here a little bit here. I might, Sharon's still here, I'm going to turn these lights down just so I can marking them a little bit. That works better here. So this is a cutaway section of where we are currently here, and I'm going to begin to unpack a lot of this notion here. But we're sort of the North Cascades are right in this area here, and there's a lot of geological action going on here that gets us to where we are. So I'm going to start way back in time, and then bring us up to the present here, and try and sketch this out a little bit with this notion of deep time. So here, just to locate ourselves in a few different ways here, this is a geological map of North America. And you can see all these bright colors, and things here is where we're located here, which means it's complicated geology. There's lots and lots of stuff going on here. With apologies to my former friends in Iowa, and if you're from Minnesota in the Midwest, nothing really interesting has happened. For hundreds of millions of years, unless you like glaciers, lots of good glacial geology there. But when I lived in Minnesota for many, many years, the rocks are really old, and it's great. But this is a stable part of the continent known as a craton, and we'll talk about what that is. The geological action is currently is happening along the Pacific coast here, and that has to do with plate tectonics, which I'll talk a little bit more about here. So the plate tectonics is a relatively recent geological theory. It really started to come together in the 1960s. I started studying geology in the late 60s and the early 70s, not knowing that I was on the front edge of a geological revolution. Up until that point, people had looked at the surface of the Earth and looked really solid. People just assumed that rocks were rocks and had always been there, so mountains were there. But what we now know is that the surface of the Earth is made up of relatively rigid plates, sections of the Earth's crust, and they move with respect to each other very slowly in terms of human time, maybe an inch or two a year, but over geological time, that leads to a lot of dynamic change here. And a couple of things, I'm probably getting myself ahead of myself a little bit here, but it is helpful to know that there are two types of Earth crust, right? There is oceanic crust, which forms the base of the Earth's oceans, and that's probably about two-thirds of the surface of the Earth. That's largely a volcanic rock known as basalt. It has a lot of iron and magnesium in it, which means it's relatively dense and heavy. Then you have what's called a continental crust. And this is the surface of the Earth that makes up our continents, North America, South America, Asia, Africa, Antarctica, so forth. And that's a little bit lighter, has more aluminum, more silica, and so forth. You don't have to worry about that. But it makes a big difference when these things move with respect to each other. So let me see if I can give you a little analogy here. How many of you have had a styrofoam kicking board or something like that in a swimming pool, right? What happens when you try to push that under the water? Bing! It tries to pop back up because it's less dense than the water there. That's the same thing with relative density here. So continents are like the styrofoam kicking boards. They're the least dense part of the continent, which means they never disappear. They're always floating on top of the rest of the Earth. And the center part of continents are the oldest parts. What happens with continents? Continents grow a little bit because we keep adding on new material on the edges. So the central parts, Minnesota, Iowa, Canada, have been around a long, long time. And the action tends to happen on the edges here where more material gets added onto them. So that's we'll talk about how that happens a little bit here. But it means for where we are in the Pacific Northwest, this is a geologically dynamic area. It's had a lot of interesting things happening for several hundred million years and continues to happen on that here. So I'm going to take us back in time, not as far as you think, all right? We're going to go back to the Triassic. This is a period about, we're going to look at about 237, 240 million years ago. Long, long time ago in terms of human scale time, this is the period of the dinosaurs and so forth, but keep in mind, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, this is only the most recent 5% of the Earth's history. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of the Earth's history we're not looking at quite here. But the key thing is back in the Triassic, the continents on the surface of the Earth were all gathered into one large supercontinent. It's known, geologists call it Pangaea. Gaea coming from the Greek term for Gaia, for meaning Earth or the Earth goddess. Pan meaning all together. And so you can see the kind of the outlines of what will one day become South America, Africa. Here's Australia, here's Antarctica, here's what will become the India, here's what North America, and there's up on the top there is Asia and Europe. And it's this since that time, this massive supercontinent has been splitting apart. But notice, the western edge of North America doesn't even exist at this point, all right? So here's, there was good things going on in Minnesota back then, 250 million years ago, right? These inland seas were going on about there here. But this whole western part of the United States didn't even exist as part of the continent here. So how do we get from that to where we are today is part of what we're going to be trying to unpack a little bit on that. So if we just move forward in time a little bit into the Jurassic, some of you are familiar with Jurassic Park and this notion, it's kind of the middle period of the age of the dinosaurs, 150 million years ago. By this time, the North America is beginning to split off from Africa and South America. And the proto-Atlantic Ocean is beginning to divide these two continents here. And so there's a lot of action going on here. Also, a lot of action going on in the whole western notion here. I'm going to come back and we'll talk more about subduction zones. But basically, when you have, well, if you think about there are three relative motions you can have with plates on the surface of the Earth. They can slide past each other, okay? And when they do that, we get big fault systems like the San Andreas Fault. Some of you are familiar with the West Coast, the San Andreas Fault is where the North American plate and the Pacific plate are sliding past each other. They can move apart from each other. And as they move apart from each other, we see this all around the world, there's volcanism that goes on, or volcanoes, mostly underwater, are these what are called mid-oceanic ridges. That's what was going on all along in here as these continents were pulling apart, big volcanic eruptions there. These are mountain ranges that are 40 to 50,000 miles long. That is by far our longest and most massive mountain ranges on Earth are below the ocean, so we don't see them very much. We didn't even know they were there until World War II, when we had submarines starting to map the ocean floors, and they found these really, really long oceanic chains there. We didn't know they were volcanic until that notion there. So we have these big long things that are going here. But since we're on a globe, and it's not expanding, if plates are moving apart in one part of the globe, what must they be doing on the other part of the globe? They're running into each other, okay? And so they're running into each other, and here's again why the difference between crust density is so important. When you have a continent running into an ocean plate there, which one's denser? The oceanic one, and it gets forced down underneath. The continents right up over the top of it here gets forced down underneath. That's what this little jagged teeth thing is showing here, that the entire coastline along what became South America, North America, was a subduction zone. So the oceanic plate over here is being pushed down underneath the continental plate. It gets really interesting when you have a continent run into another continent. Neither one can force the other one down. So what happens when continents run into each other? They crumple upward here. And you don't see it quite yet here, but pretty soon, this little piece of this continent, which is going to become modern-day India, is going to break off here and start traveling up here, and eventually it's going to run into modern-day Tibet. And what results?
The Himalayas.
Thank you, Barbara. And what we don't see in this earlier picture here, if I've gone back a little bit, this seam is here. Previously, these have been separated apart, and they had collided. So the whole mountain belt where they collided with each other, which in the United States are the Appalachians. If you go over to Morocco, they're the Atlas Mountains. They continue on up through, this is northern Scotland, in the UK, and into Scandinavia. These mountains, they're ancient mountains. And so these are the Appalachians at some point may have been 30 to 40,000 feet high. They may have been higher than our modern day Himalaya. Give you just a second here. So they formed for this first initial closing, and now they're spreading apart here. And since that time, the Appalachians have basically been passively riding along on the northern end. So they've slowly just been eroding. So if you go to the Appalachians today, what you're seeing is the ancient core, the ancient interior of a much, much older mountain range. Question
here. What's the force that drives?
We're going to get to that. What's the force that drives all this? Why do we have a dynamic Earth that's moving around like this? It's really fascinating. It's one of the things that separates us, as far as we know, the only planet in the solar system that has this active, what we call, plate tectonics. Mars doesn't have it. Moon doesn't have it. Venus is harder to tell. Mercury doesn't have it. And the other planets are gaseous, so they don't have it. These are the ones here. Who's the hand over here?
Gulf of Mexico.
You
just showed up.
Yeah. And this is one of the more complex pieces of geology in this area. Again, if we go back, you'll see that, there was a little, some kind of basin in here. This whole, because this is partly what's called a suture zone. When continents run together, collide together, they get stitched together in a new continent called a suture zone. Some of you may know, anybody know what separates Asia from Europe? The Ural Mountains. The Ural Mountains is what technically, Eurasia technically is one continent itself there. But the Ural Mountains are an ancient suture zone when the European mass and the Asian mass were separate continents. They collided together, created that whole big mountain range, and they've been stuck together ever since that time. This is a suture zone that created these mountain ranges here. Very complex geology in the Gulf of Mexico, and I'll try and come back a little bit, even though it's a little bit distant from our story. So I'm going to move us along because I do want to get Pacific Northwest here, but it's sort of just establishing some of the basics about how the Earth has been moving around here. And do stop me if you've got questions that I'm not clear about. By 150 million years ago, we are beginning to separate the two continents here, and notice this subduction zone here is all along the western United States. So think of it in a minute here. When these rocks, you've got the oceanic over here, the ocean floor, and you've got the continents over here. As they're colliding, the ocean floor is being pushed down underneath the continent. What's happening, do you think, to these rocks on the ocean floor? What happens to the temperature as you go further down in the Earth's surface?
It's hotter.
It's much hotter. What happens to pressure? It really increases here. And so, but begins to happen, and just very, very quickly here, this ocean floor, again, formed by underwater volcanoes. As those volcanoes erupt underwater and form lava flows, they're picking up water from the ocean in there, so they're incorporating water into the rocks as they go along. Perfectly fine as long as they're underwater there. Now they're being forced down under the subduction zone. Water in particular begins to react to increased heat and pressure. It begins to basically boil off. So it begins to melt the rocks there, and now you get a molten rock here, which tends to be more dense, solid or liquid?
Solid.
So if you've got liquid rock, which is less dense underneath all this other rock, and that forms the magma that begins to move upward and forms volcanoes. So we have a whole big volcanic chain all the way along North America, South America. South America, this will become the Andes Mountains. North America is going to become the Sierra Nevadas, the Cascades, all that kind of there. So we've got a lot of activity going along over here in this early picture on this here. All right, so now we begin to move. Now we move into the Cretaceous. It's the most recent, the last pair with dinosaurs here. Cretaceous is a fascinating time because sea level was much higher than it is today for a variety of different reasons I'm not going to go into right now. But so you can see the continents are still moving apart, but they're also getting flooded. So the whole central part of North America exists under a shallow sea. And this is so where I come from in Montana. The whole eastern part of Montana was underwater at this point. We have these Cretaceous sandstones and limestones from there and that area there. So North America now is a series of different islands all connected to each other. Much of South America is inundated here. Still got the Andes here, but right behind them. So sea level is much higher. But the continents are beginning to take some of their shape here. Notice India has broken off from Antarctica. Antarctica has broken off from South America and Africa. Australia, interesting, is still connected to Antarctica. But India is going to move very, very quickly up into Asia in the next notion here. But we're concerned about the action over here. Notice we've got now subduction zones of volcanoes here, but we've got what are called the ancestral Rocky Mountains. The Rocky Mountains are beginning to push up. Because two things are happening. When you get the collision of plates, not only are you getting one plate pushed down and begin to form volcanoes, the pressure of this plate begins to crumple the edge as well. So we get both volcanoes and mountains forming along the western edge of the United States or North America. So now we're going to hone back in a little bit further here. This is a geographic map, just showing the geography of Washington area, the Pacific Northwest. Really, really interesting piece, Vancouver Island. It's a very, very dramatic event. The Olympic Peninsula with the mountains over here. Puget Sound. So one of the things right now is sea level is actually quite a bit higher than it was 5-10 million years ago here. Puget Sound is basically a drowned river system. There's all these rivers that came in here, and then you raise the sea level and they get drowned in there. Here are the Cascade Mountains with very distinct volcanoes, Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams, Mount Rainier, Glacier Peaks up in here, Mount Baker up there, goes on into Canada. Behind it, we have this broad plain, which we're going to talk about here, relatively level in eastern Washington, with mountains to the north surrounding it all around there. So that's our basic geography. And what geologists try to do, they treat this as like a big detective game. We know how the story turns out. That's where we are right now. How do we get there? So it's like a detective. A crime is committed. You have the crime scene. You know that. You're looking for the clues. How did we get to that point here? And then, so geologists try to explain all these different features in the story over time. That's what I'm going to try and do a little bit here today. Okay, so here's another little bit different. It's not so easy to see, but let's see if I can walk us through a little bit here. This is, again, the story of plate tectonics seen at a global level. By far the largest plate, the largest section of the Earth's surface that moves as one unit is the Pacific Plate. Pacific Plate is a very, very large volcanic plate here. All these little craggy little things on there that you see out of the oceans there, they come down here. There's another one that goes right here. They look like suture zones that connect the planet there. Those are all what are called these spreading centers. These are where plates are spreading apart, and these are all mountain ranges of volcanoes. So new crust is being formed here. Most of the surface of the Earth is tens of millions, if not billions of years old, but some places you can go and you can actually see new crust. Anybody here in the Big Island of Hawaii? Yes. If you walk across that crater there right next to Kilauea, I told my sister, I said, it's one of the few places where you can walk on crust that's younger than you are. Those eruptions are from the 1950s and 1960s, so you're walking on crust that's younger than us. But most places are much, much older. So this is all places where new crust, where the oceans are spreading apart of these things here. And so it gets interesting, then you have the South American plate, which is made up both of continent and a piece of oceanic crust. So plates can be a little confusing because they can be all just oceanic crust, they can be all just continental crust, but oftentimes they take both of them. And all this simply means is this chunk of the Earth's surface is working together as a unit. So it's spreading out of the Atlantic Ocean here, same way Africa is spreading out here, but that means they're colliding over here. So this Pacific edge here, one of the reasons the Pacific Ocean is so interesting, or the Pacific Rim is so interesting, is that the middle of the Pacific Ocean is a spreading center. You're getting more and more oceanic crust, which means all the edges of the Pacific Ocean, both over here and also over here, are colliding zones. And that's, again, where so much of the geological actions happens. Where our earthquakes happen along here, our volcanic eruptions happen, the mountain building happened. So geologists call this the Pacific Ring of Fire. You may hear that because it's circled by volcanoes, circled by earthquakes on that. And it gets really complex here because the Nazca Plate is a large plate off of South America. Then the Cocos Plate is off of Central America. If you've been to Central America, you know that Costa Rica, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Southern Mexico are all volcanoes. There's subduction going on there. Then notice what happens. This spreading center actually runs under the North American continent. That means the North American continent has slid over it. So what happens to this plate boundary when the North American continent turns into a major fault? And that's the San Andreas Fault. So San Andreas Fault comes right along through here. So if any of you have ever intuited that Southern California and Los Angeles is a little bit different than the rest of the country, it is. It's the only part of our country that's not on the North American plate. It's on its entire plate. It's on the Pacific plate. So it's and south. So San and by my partner from the Bay Area, who reminds us all the time, but Southern California, where I grew up, is sliding north relative to Northern California. And so much to my partner Pat's horror, within a few 10 million years, so Los Angeles is going to be right next to San Francisco. We have a major rivalry between the Dodgers and the Giants in our family here, so that'll be a cross bay experience at that point. But the San Andreas Fault slides under there, and then it comes back out in Northern California, and we have this little tiny plate up here called the Juan de Fuca Plate from the San Juan Islands in there, and that's what's generating so much of the action off of here. We're going to hone in on that. All sorts of really exciting things. If you pay attention here, Africa is actually moving north and running into Europe, which is where we get the Alps. It's where we get the volcanoes in Italy and Greece and so forth. So this is going on here. This is the other part of the planet where just so much stuff is happening because you've got Africa and the Indian plate running into Asia. So Asia's got very, very complex geology. You'll notice we always have major earthquakes every few years in Iran and Iraq. In Pakistan, you know, because all this geology is going on there. All right, so let's see if we can hone in a little further here. So here's our local context. This is a bird's eye view of there. So again, these little teeth marks here is where the ocean plate, here in the case of the Juan de Fuca plate, is being pushed down under the North American plate. So what makes our corner of the world so fascinating is we've got all the different plate boundaries are all located here. So remember we said one of the places is plates can move apart from each other, they can spread apart from each other. That's what's going on out here. This is the Pacific plate, this is the Juan de Fuca plate, and they are spreading apart from each other. So this is a whole series of underwater volcanoes just off our coast. Then you've got this little plate, the Juan de Fuca plate, it's being forced down underneath the North American plate. So we have a subduction zone, and it's right off the coast here. Usually there's a, from the edge of these are called trenches, or the subduction zone, from that edge, it's usually about 30 or 40 miles inland before you start getting the first volcanoes, because this plate has to get deep enough to start melting. So sure enough, about 30 or 40 miles inland, we start getting all the cascade volcanoes coming along in this area here. And then south of us and north of us, these turn into what are called transform faults, where the plates begin to slide past each other there. So lots and lots of action going on here. This is a little bit more of a cutaway of it. And so if we looked on the sideways there, here's the ocean ridge here, where you've got the two plates splitting apart here. Now the Juan de Fuca plate is being pushed down under the North American plate here. All of these little dots here are earthquake zones. This is where the earthquakes are happening, because you've got rocks sliding past each other, and the pressure builds up, and then it'll give, and that's an earthquake, and it gives, and that's an earthquake. So a lot of fairly shallow earthquakes in here mark the upper boundary of this plate moving down here. Here is all these little dots here is where it's starting to get deep enough that it's beginning to melt, and it's forming magma chambers under the earth there, which are feeding the volcanoes. And we're right up in here. There's Glacier Peak. So this is sort of where we're locating in here, on some of that. Is this making sense of our broad outline? Stop me if I'm going too quickly, any other questions on here. So part of our context here is the plate tectonics are these Cascadia earthquakes here. And I'm going to end the talk. We'll talk about the benefits of plate tectonics and some of the challenges for humans on here. So we have a lot of benefits from coming from these earthquakes. They have shaped all the topography we live in here. Amazing Puget Sound, the volcanoes provide very fertile soil. So if you're interested in the good wine growing that we've got going in the Washington area now, our agriculture, things like that. But one of the big challenges is earthquakes. And the Cascadia Fault, we pay a lot of attention to the San Andreas Fault, because we've had major earthquakes on the San Andreas Fault in U.S. history, particularly the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. People have paid a lot less attention to the Cascadia Fault system, these Cascadia earthquakes, which actually historically have been much larger than the San Andreas Fault ones. And we're going to come back and talk about that, because the combination, these earthquakes tend to be destructive in at least a couple different ways. One is the earthquakes themselves are really large when they happen. They're sometimes up to 9 point, on the Richter scale, some of the largest known earthquakes here. But they also, because they happen underwater, they oftentimes set off tsunamis. And that's part of it, or tidal waves, and that's part of what makes this area really vulnerable. We'll come back and talk more about that here. But you can begin to see these maps, these crustal faults or faults that are earthquakes that happen up in the crust as the rocks get sliding past each other. And then we have these really deep-seated faults that are happening way below the surface as the plate is sliding back down under there. And each of these different earthquakes have kind of a different personality in terms of the effects that they have. But we'll come back and talk about that. You can see some of these occurrences here. These really, the subduction zone ones, which can be really, really powerful, tend to happen on a 500 to 600 year cycle. And we haven't paid much attention to them until recently, because it's been at least 300 or 400 years since we had one happen in the Pacific Northwest, which means we're probably due relatively soon for another one in that. The deep Juan de Fuca, these ones happening down here, happen a little more frequently on that. Now, the other thing that makes this geological crime scene so difficult to unravel is that the whole western part of North America is full of rocks that didn't form here. They formed way across the ocean in other places. Right? Some of them formed in the tropics. And so one of the really puzzling things, you go up to Alaska, anybody been to Wrangell, Mount Wrangell, St. Elias, Alaska National Park? those, a lot of those rocks there, and that is, geologists call that the Rango terrain or Rangelia, a lot of those rocks formed in the tropics. The geologists got up there, and you're up in Alaska, and all the fossils are tropical fossils. So how in the world did you get tropical fossils forming up in Alaska? Well, they formed on all these different kind of island systems here, and then the ocean moved them across until they eventually get plastered onto the edge of the continent here. So you can imagine now, think about an island like Indonesia, thousands and thousands of islands in Indonesia. If Indonesia, over a great amount of time, migrated across the Pacific Plate and got plastered onto North America, future geologists are going to look at these rocks that clearly didn't form in our latitudes. I had to figure that out. And so that's what we have going on here. Vancouver Island is this entire little microplate, entire thing formed way, thousands of miles away, has been mashed onto here. The Olympic Peninsula, same thing. The rocks that formed the Olympic Peninsula didn't form, but they formed much farther away. And because of this constant movement, so this map here just shows all these different islands that were forming elsewhere, and then they get accreted or smashed onto here. So what you see in the west is all these north-south trending lines, our mountain ranges, our fault systems, they all reflect the subduction zone, and they all reflect these islands coming along and getting mushed onto the west coast. The Cascades, I'll show you a slide of this in a moment here, really seems like it. So this again is a diagrammatic one of what's happening if you did a cross section about our Pacific Northwest here. So out in the, and somebody asked about how is this all working? So maybe this is what we can talk about here. What we see, but we have several places. If you saw the movie, the Journey of the Universe, remember when he cut open the hard-boiled egg and he said the hard-boiled egg, Earth is like a hard-boiled egg, has a solid core like the yolk, and has what's called the mantles like the white, and has a very thin eggshell crust here. So our crust is only somewhere between 15 to 50 miles thick or so in there. So from here to Wenatchee, you know, here to Chelan, if you turn that on an edge, that's about how thick our crust is. It varies in some places, very thin in the ocean, thicker in the continents there. Below that is a very, very large area, the mantle. The mantle is solid, but it is under great heat and pressure, so it moves like a liquid over time. So the way I think about this is imagine a Hershey bar, Hershey's chocolate bar. Take it out of the freezer. What's it like if you try to bend it? Very brittle. It'll just break, right? Leave that Hershey bar sitting on the sun for a little while, and then you pick it up and it just goes, you know, you're just sad. It's still solid, but it's become liquid. And that's what's going on in liquid movements. That's what's happening in the mantle. So because at the center of the Earth there are still a lot of radiometric minerals that are breaking down over time. As radiometric minerals break down, they release energy, they release heat. So we have a heat source at the center of the Earth that keeps generating heat. Heat will move out towards the colder places there. And it creates, and so it begins to migrate up here and creates a subduction or a convection current that the rocks actually moving here. You can demonstrate this really well in your kitchen if you're ever interested about this. If you've ever made pea soup and just let it cool, what happens to the surface of the soup? You get a crust forming out of there. Now, if you reheat it, what begins to happen if you just leave it alone there? You get bubbles coming up, right? The water begins to heat up below, and it actually begins to migrate up. And if you just leave it alone, it'll take that pea soup crust, and it'll push it to the sides of the pot there. So the pea soup crust is like our crust on here. It's rigid, but it's got a liquid source below that's coming up below and spreading out. That's what's happening here. We get this magma coming up, and it begins to erupt under the ocean, spreads out here, forces us down. And then we get here, they got Mount Baker here, and then these really complex rocks over here, which is where we are, the messed up rocks. So we'll talk about that a little bit here. So this is a cross section of the North Cascades, just a little bit north of here, but the basic thing here. And we're not going to spend a lot of time, and it's going to be a mess here, but you've got all sorts of, these rocks and that we see on Holden are called metamorphic rocks. You've got three, I'm sorry, I'm trying to give you an intro to geology course in one lecture here, so but three basic rock types found on the surface of the Earth here. They reflect the history of the Earth. The oldest and the original rocks are igneous. The Earth used to be a liquid, so hot that all the rocks had melted. It was a liquid planet, and it cooled over time, but we still have constantly new liquid rocks or volcanic rocks being generated. When those rocks reach the surface, they erupt and become volcanoes. So you see that here. But a lot of times the magma never reaches the surface. It moves upward and then it stays below the surface and cools in place. And those become rocks like granite. So if you've been to Yosemite, you'll see a lot of granitic rocks there. These are ancient magma pools that were way below the surface, and they cool there, and they've been uplifted now. We have a lot of those right around here. We hike around. If we walked outside, I could pick up the rocks and show you a lot of those here. But mostly what we have here are all these older, a second type of rock, which are called sedimentary rocks. Sedimentary rocks began as other rocks, and they broke down, so they become sandstone, or mudstone, or siltstone. So they're the erosional remnants of earlier rocks there that the rivers or water or wind deposit in place, and they build back up, and you get layers of them. So if you've been to the Grand Canyon, you see all those layers stacked up on top of each other, sandstone and limestones. Limestones form from, and I'll talk much more about this tomorrow, but limestones form from the collection of fossil shells. So it's like seashells. All the creatures in the earth have calcite shells, they do that. And then the third one is metamorphic, simply means changed form. These are rocks that have been either heated or put under a lot of pressure. They can either be igneous rocks or sedimentary rocks, but they've been changed in their form because they've been subject to a lot of intense pressure and heat. That's what all this stuff is here, and that's what most of Holden is here. You hike around here, we're looking at rocks that have been through a long history of heat and pressure at different times, uplifted, folded, heated, and so forth, they've recrystallized. So we have these very complex geology stuff in here. And then all of them are just fractured by all these fault zones, these vertical lines here, because as you put this pressure on there, the rocks begin to crumple, and then they begin to slip and break and move past each other. So the local picture in Holden is really complex. One last thing I'll mention, we're going to back about it here, but these rocks then oftentimes they'll get intruded later by these igneous rocks, these liquid rocks. And those liquid rocks then will fill the cracks of these other rocks there. And as they do that, they oftentimes, what's called precipitate out, or they concentrate the metals that are in them. And these form the ore bodies. So Copper Mountain is a good example of these metamorphic rocks that the magma came in and filled all these cracks there, and the ore minerals became concentrated in the cracks of copper, silver, gold, and so forth. And so they're what result in the ore geology that then later on gets mined down in that area. Okay? So that's as much detail at this point I'm going to talk about here. But let me just see if there's questions before I move on. I realize I'm covering a lot of territory. I'm going to try to do the big picture and keep filling us in. Yes?
It looked to me like you said the Pacific Plate was going under California. But up here in the northwest, the Pacific Plate is moving away.
It's actually the other way around. The Pacific Plate is sliding past California, and where they're sliding past each other, that's the San Andreas Fault, called a transform fault. Here, the Pacific Plate is actually being pushed down underneath us. So if we go back here, this is what's happening up in Washington here. The Pacific Plate is being pushed down. This is the North American Plate up here, and this is riding over the top of it there.
Where is the Juan de Fuca Plate?
So this is the one that, well, actually, you're right. This is the Juan de Fuca Plate. This is the Pacific Plate from over here. This is a spreading center. This is the Juan de Fuca Plate, and there's very little of it left. Right? And so in a few million years, it'll disappear entirely. So if we go back, So here you can see, it's just this little remnant right here is the Juan de Fuca Plate. It starts in Northern California or Southern Oregon. It goes up to Southern British Columbia. It's a very small remnant of plate. It used to be much, much larger. It's just being devoured by the plate here. Everything on the other side of it is the Pacific Plate. So they're spreading apart from each other. And the Juan de Fuca Plate now is being forced underneath the North American Plate.
So Dan, can we expect to see a new mountain range coming? Are there going to be more volcanoes out there?
Yes, you're getting ahead of me, but exactly, because I'm going to see, because let me just anticipate, anybody driven across eastern Washington? What's the big rock type? All the way from Spokane to Wenatchee you see out there?
Lava.
Basalt. Lots of basalt. Lava basalt. Okay, so we're going to talk about what's going on there, because it's going to be related to this here. I'll add a new wrinkle at that point. Okay, so this is what we've been talking about. Subduction then is the reason that we have this incredible mountain range all along the western coast here that's full of volcanoes. So I grew up spending my summers on the Medicine Lake volcano, which is near Mount Shasta in the northern part of there. Some of you have been to Crater Lake. You've got this whole volcanic complex going up here, and it goes quite a ways into southern British Columbia there. And notice it coincides almost exactly with where the Juan de Fuca plate, there's a little teeny little one here that they call the Gorda plate, but it's all basically one set one here, where these are being pushed down underneath here. Lassen Peak is the farthest south volcano. From that point, because this is where the San Andreas Fault comes out of California. So everything down here is sliding, it's sliding like this. The Pacific Plate's coming up here, and then you have the Mendocino Fault, and then you get active subduction. North of Vancouver Island, that area there, we have another big fault system. It's called the Queen Charlotte Fault. It's like the San Andreas Fault, where they're sliding past each other. But this is where all the volcanic action is happening. This is the trench. This is the actual belt where it's being slid down here under the area there. And there's, again, diagrammatic in profile.
So when Mount St. Helens blew, why was that the only one that blew? Why didn't rain?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Adams blow at the same time.
Yeah. So thank you for that question, because what happens, and this is on this plate boundary here, you begin to get the rocks begin to melt off, and actually, what's actually happening technically is the water, so this is volcanic rock that has water in it from when it erupted under the ocean. As it goes down there, the water begins to boil off, and what melts is actually the lower part of the crust. So the water is driven up, it's really, really hot water under pressure, driven up, and it begins to melt these rocks. Small little droplets of them, they eventually coalesce together in a magma chamber there. And then what drives those eruptions are the gases that are in that liquid there. So you think about having a pressure cooker, right? What happens if you keep boiling water, and you don't relieve the pressure on it? It explodes, right? That's what happens with volcanoes as well. And so these magma chambers are happening all up and down underneath it. There's magma chambers all up and down these different areas. Different ages, right? It takes a while for each one to build up the pressure in them, the gases and stuff, to all of a sudden begin to drive the material up there. So Mount St. Helens is the most recent one. When I was studying geology, part of Mount St. Helens, what volcano people were expecting to erupt next?
Baker.
Mount Baker was the one that people thought was most likely because it shows a lot of signs of activity. Mount Lassen erupted most recently. Prior to that, about 100 years ago, Mount Lassen was erupting here. Some of these volcanoes are probably dead. That means that their magma chamber no longer is active. It's solidified under there. Other way, we can expect there'll be new volcanoes that we don't have in current there, but they're all in different kind of stages and different levels of activity, depending on how much liquid rock they have in their magma chamber, how many pressure or gases they have in there, and it takes a while to build up. It's sort of like if you've been to Yellowstone and seen the geysers. The geyser will erupt, and then there's a lag time where the water comes back down. It's slowly building up more and more gases until it reaches a pressure point, blows up again. So that's why Mount St. Helens just happened to be the one with the most active magma chamber right now. Glacier Peak has erupted several times in the last 10 or 12,000 years. Barbara and I have done some wonderful hikes that you can do. You get up high around here, and it's really wild. There's a place not far from here called Ice Lakes, about 7,500 feet. Beautiful area, but the first time I went there, it was so strange for me because it's surrounded by pumice. There's all this pumice up there. And it's from Glacier Peak. When Glacier Peak erupted, it blew out all this rock there. And I got to keep moving. We're never going to get done here. Okay. So that's our basic background here. And so it's our fire and ice and the explosive history here. These are just some examples. Probably the most dangerous volcano, and my apologies to folks here, but Mount Rainier, probably the most dangerous volcano because it's so close to such a big metropolitan area, the Seattle, Tacoma, Puget Sound area there. Here's Mount St. Helens erupting here. Mount St. Helens, very close to Portland, but Portland largely escaped its effects because it blew almost all the ash inland. Crater Lake, it's a remnants of Mount Mazama, probably the largest explosion, at least in the last several tens of thousands of years, actually blew the top off of there and created this big caldera in there. And there's Glacier Peak, which is a nearby one, which doesn't seem to be terribly active right now. We're probably in a pretty good spot on that here. Now, the second part of the story that I want to just mention here, so you understand our geology, if you've driven across northern Oregon or southern, southeastern Washington, it's just miles and miles and miles of basalt. And if these basalts are called the Columbia River basalt, they're over a mile thick. They date back to about 15, 16, 17 million years ago, which geologically speaking is relatively recent. And this, it's a new, I have to introduce a different kind of notion here. How many folks, what is the geology of Yellowstone National Park? Anybody know?
It's a volcano.
It's called a super volcano. It's one of the largest volcanoes on the planet. All right. When it has eruptions, it has enormous eruptions here. And it's located right up here in the northwestern part of Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, right in here. If you go from Yellowstone, you can see there's this broad tract of these basalts that go down here, and they go from age, from almost relatively recent to getting older and older and older. That is, they trace a trend there across from the southwest to the northeast that now culminates in Yellowstone. What geologists think that Yellowstone is an example of a hot spot. So hot spots are a little complicated. Explain, I don't know if I have a good profile here. What a hot spot is the hot spots seem to have their source of a magma chamber way in the mantle and really deep. And what happens is they don't tend to move with respect to Earth, so they're constantly setting up magma there, but the surface keeps moving over it. And so you're going to get a constant magma. You have a really good example that the Hawaiian Islands are thought to be source of a hot spot. If you're familiar with Hawaii, it's a series of volcanoes that go from the northwest up at Kauai and get further and further southeast until you get to the island of Hawaii. It's the youngest, it's currently active. And actually, there's another island forming. It's still below sea level, southeast of Hawaii. That's because you have a hot spot there, and the plate is moving off to the northwest, so it keeps setting up right there and keeps getting this chain of volcanoes. We think that the Yellowstone volcano is a hot spot that began out in the ocean there with those plates there. But then again, as North America began to move over and devour those other plates there, the hotspot didn't disappear. It now is found under the continent. And what we see is, it's from a position of kind of the southwest up to the northeast, we have this chain of these big, big flood basalts. So the Columbia River flood basalts came from a series of a whole bunch of fractures and fissures that this hotspot was sending a magma there, interrupting this area, and then it flooded into the topography, flowed down the Columbia River all the way out to the ocean, filled back in the Willamette there here. So this happened over a couple million years, most of it here. Enormous amounts of rock erupted. As I mentioned, over a mile deep, about 6,000 feet deep here. It's a whole other thing. I'll talk more about climate change tomorrow, because flood basalts have been really connected to climate change. When they happen, they also emit enormous amounts of gases, particularly carbon dioxide, other ones that can actually change the climate of the Earth there, volcanic eruptions. But just since you can see, it's a really interesting, there's such a massive amount of lava erupted that it actually flowed across. This is the whole Cascade Mountain Range there. The only outlet it could have was the Columbia River Valley. And so if you go through the Columbia River Gorge, you'll see just lots and lots of basalts on either side there. Now, the reason we have a valley there is, and that's another part of the story that I'll move us along to here. We're getting up more towards the recent here. We, for the last 3 million years, the Earth has been predominantly in an ice age. We're in an inter-ice interlude right now, a relatively warm period, but most of the last 3 million years, the Earth's temperature has been much cooler here. It's a period that geologists call the Pleistocene. And you may be familiar that just north of here, we had an entire continental ice sheet that covered almost all of Canada and came down into North America. Those of you from the Midwest, anybody here from Decorah? I know we had some Decorah folks here
close
at the college.
Real close to Decorah.
Yeah, and you're in this little pair that the ice actually didn't cover. It actually went around that. But I was in Iowa and Des Moines. It got all the way down to Des Moines, covered much of Wisconsin, Minnesota. Here in the West, it covered Seattle, would have been covered by it. The whole Puget Sound was covered by it. And then you had it coming down into the northern parts here. Here's where I live in Missoula. I'm going to talk a minute about Glacial Lake Missoula. But the ice age here was responsible for a lot of the glacial features we see in the mountains here. Because while it was a continental ice sheet, it also just covered, there was ice and big glaciers in all the mountains nearby. So this is kind of the most recent period here. And this is taken actually up in Alaska and Canada. But this is what a lot of this area would have looked like as recently as 10, 15,000 years ago. With all of our valleys, this Lake Chelan Valley, the Railroad Creek Valley, would have all been filled with these rivers of ice and glaciers there. And then the mountains themselves covered with all these hanging valleys on that there. So these produce the features that we see very typical for today. Our valleys would have had big rivers of ice in them. Any of the side valleys would have had glaciers in them, but they would have been smaller. And the glaciers, their carving power depends on their weight. This is the mass they have. So the bigger valleys have big glaciers and they're carving down at a faster rate. The side valleys have glaciers in them, but they're shorter rate. So when the glaciers disappear, you'll have a gap between the side valley and the lower valley here. Mm-hmm. And that's what creates some of our wonderful waterfalls here. So best example from the village, you look across, you see Copper Falls there. That's the Copper Basin is a hanging valley with a waterfall coming out of it here. But if you came up the lake, you saw Domke Falls from the lake. There's a hanging valley there. So we got all these glacial things here. Then we get these really ruggedly carved mountains because they had glaciers on several sides and they carved the horns, the Matterhorn being the most famous part of them. There are lots and lots of different things. Glaciers, glacial areas oftentimes have lots of lakes because they leave what are called these terminal moraines. Wherever the glacier is ending there, it's constantly depositing ground up rock and so forth there. When the glacier retreats, it forms a natural dam across the valley there. Or it encounters a harder rock unit there. So if you've maybe hiked up to Heart Lake, the last thing you do when you go up that ridge, you come that trail, the steep climb up there, there's that ridge that comes across it. That forms the dam that puts Heart Lake in there. So Holden Lake, similar. We have lots of lakes in there. So this is our most recent thing here. And here's just some examples of it. So you imagine Lake Chelan now as ice. It would have been much filled with ice here. This is the Railroad Creek Valley, comes up here. It would have been a glacier. Here's Domke Lake. This would have been a glacier here. All of this area here. This is our area here. So Mount Bonanza there actually still has some small glaciers on it. The top there is Mary Green Glacier on the right, Acela Glacier on the left. And here's the Holden Lake sits back in there. And this is a good example of a hanging valley. So you have the waterfalls coming out as we come down here. This is again up by Lyman Lakes areas there. So all of our immediate features here are glacially carved in there. But a really interesting part of the story is what happened when this ice sheet came down. And this is where I live in Missoula. We've got this interesting thing here. I mentioned before that geology is like a big detective story. And the fascinating thing, there was about 100 years ago, there was a geologist working here in Washington named J. Harlan Bretz. And he was trying to make sense of all these really, really strange geological features out in eastern Washington, where you have, in a desert, you have these big valleys that got carved and looked like they were carved by water. You look like you have these dry waterfall areas. All these different features that look like they're water-based, but they're out in a desert. There was no obvious source for water to do this. He slowly reconstructed the whole thing, and he hypothesized there had to have been some catastrophic floods that swept across all of eastern Washington there and down through and carved the Columbia River Gorge. It was a very unpopular geological hypothesis because it happened the same time as the Scopes Monkey Trial. And the Scopes Monkey Trial, the fundamentalists were arguing that Noah's Flood was responsible for everything. And geologists had spent 100 years trying to discount Noah's Flood and saying there are other causes. And he comes along and proposes a catastrophic flood as being their thing there. So it took about 40 or 50 years for geologists to come around and accept his story. What we now think happened here, and we have a lot of good evidence for this, is this ice sheet came down, and the Clark Fork River, this is where Missoula, Montana is, the Clark Fork River comes out through a very narrow valley here, and this ice sheet kept coming down and blocking that valley. So it created an ice dam. That ice dam was over 2,000 feet high, so it backed up all the water to an enormous amount of water. So there was as much water in this glacial Lake Missoula as the combined water in the Great Lakes today. It's so deep. It's a lot of water. Now, what happens to ice when you put it in liquid water? It floats, all right? So one of the problems is you have an ice dam here, and you have all this water behind it. At a certain point, it began to float that ice dam. And once it started floating that ice dam, water began to escape underneath it, and then it just fractured and collapsed. So now you have got all of this water backed up like a combined Great Lakes there, all flowing out at the same time. And so it flowed through this area and it hit the constricted area here, gorge. What happens when you constrict water in a narrow area but you've got a lot of force behind it? It
goes faster.
Yeah, it comes out like a fire hose. That's what higher fire hoses do, is they keep the pressure there. So it comes just roaring out here, hits this broad area of all these flat Columbia faults here, and just scours it. Just creates all these different canyons, waterfalls. To give you a sense about this, geologists estimate that this would happen in about 3 or 4 days. The amount of water flowing was 10 times the total amount of water in our world's rivers today.
Wow.
You take the Amazon, the Nile, the Mississippi, all the world's rivers, 10 times that amount of water was flowing across eastern Washington. And so you can imagine what kind of level of flood this was. And then it comes across here and it gets concentrated back down again here. So now we put another fire hose, and it's like a fire hose going through here, and that's what caused the Columbia River gorge, deepened it. The force was so great that it actually flowed 100 miles back upstream in the Willamette Valley, reaching as far south as Eugene and Corvallis, if you have any Oregonians here, on that area there, and then eventually out into the ocean here. So this carved our notion here. So there's the dimensions of it. It's the lake was formed back here, the dam was here, the dam breaks, it begins to flood across here, gets concentrated in the Columbia River Gorge, and eventually comes out here, backflows into the Willamette. We see evidence of this every day. This is the University of Montana, where Pat and I teach here. See all these lines on the hillside? What do you think those are? Those are ancient shorelines of Glacial Lake Missoula. This didn't happen just once. It happened sometime between 55 and 60 times over about a 3,000-year period. So the dam would build up, it would break, big flood there, ice kept coming down from the north, that continental glacier was still there, it would dam that thing back up again, it would slowly fill the lake back up again, it would reach that high level there. And it seems like every time it went just a little bit lower, so you can count there's at least 55 of these ancient shore beds there. Geologists call them strand lines on that area. When I was a student of geology and teaching geology in the 70s in Montana, we would take students up to, this is a semi-truck down here. This is a place called Camas Prairie in Montana. It's about 70 or 80 miles northwest of Missoula. These are giant ripple marks. So if you've ever been to a little beach shore or a little stream, you see all the little ripple marks there? These are on the order of 200 feet wide and 50 to 60 feet high. And it's a place, again, where the water was flowing here so fast, it left all the sediments in these big ripple mark things there. This is a place called Dry Falls. It's just off of Highway 2. As you come through Cooley City, there's a wonderful state park you'll get a chance to. These were all enormous waterfalls flowing, and then you carved out these big, big potholes as the water came rushing over eastern Washington there. There's a couple places, yeah, back here, Ron.
Real quick, I'm trying to figure out the timing. Is this around?
So this is about 12 to 15,000 years ago.
So we think there were people.
This is a really interesting thing. There's been big debates because many of the indigenous communities in this area have in their legends stories of big, big floods. And so it's quite possible. What's controversial about this is there's still big debates among anthropologists about when the first indigenous people arrived from Asia. One group says they arrived about 12 to 13,000 years ago. Another group says it was earlier, about 22,000 years. Still debates on this. If it was earlier, there definitely were people here. They would have had to be in very strategic spots to be able to watch this and survive it. Because it basically just wiped out all of eastern Washington. But if you were up on a hillside and watched it, it would have been quite a wild ride if your boat had been out on the lake when this took off there. But we do have legends, and so it's quite possible that where people witnessed this. And of course, it would happen in 3 or 4 days, and then any survivors would have this completely scoured out and devastated landscape. I mean, every tree, every animal, everything would have been gone there. And then you'd see it recover over 30 or 40 or 50 years, and just as you think our mine town is going to take a while to recover, well, imagine half a state of Washington now on that. So it's a really fascinating period here. We just have all these, and it's helped us explain all these clues that seem unrelated. We have some places now where we still have Palouse Falls, where some streams are taking advantage of these scoured out channels. We actually have rivers coming through them here. If you've been in the Columbia River Gorge, geologists have long called the Columbia River itself an underfit stream. That is, there isn't enough water in the Columbia River to have carved the depth of the gorge there, so they didn't know how it had gotten so deep and so scour. Now we think it was from the floods in that area there. This is one of my favorite ones here. This is a piece of rock. This rock found is found, it's really common where I live in Montana. It's not common at all in Oregon. And this is just outside McMinnville in Oregon. You find these big, big pieces of rock that came from nearly 1,000 miles away. And geologists couldn't figure out how in the world they have gotten there. What they think now is that these rocks were actually contained in icebergs. That is, they're part of all the ice that was there when the dam broke. All the ice came roaring down like styrofoam, things like that, backflowed up in the Eugene area there, and then when the ice melted, these rocks dropped out. But these are they're really fascinating things like that. So all these different pieces of the puzzle came together here. So I'm going to bring this up to our modern day here. We'll take a few more minutes and just get it. So that's the backdrop of where we got to where we are today. This is the geologic story, the Holden Mine here. It brings up all sorts of different pieces of this here. We've got Copper Mountain here and the metamorphic rocks there that the magma body came in and deposited the ore. We've got these big, broad, U-shaped valleys that make it possible in there. The mining of that is now part of the story that we're looking at here. And our mine reclamation is part now of this geologic story. These tailings are not being removed, they're being remediated, they're going to be covered up. But we were now, this will be a new story. So you can imagine a geologist a million years from now coming in, or maybe even 50,000 years from now, coming into this valley and having to look and say, how in the world did this stuff form? Okay, and to reconstruct that story. And that. So I want to just end with this combination. So what difference does any of this make for us today? For those of us who live here, geology creates the world that we inhabit and provides what I would call both geological hazards and geological blessings. So we live in an area that has a lot of both, for better or for worse. So geological hazards of the Pacific Northwest, earthquakes are a big one. As I mentioned before, this Cascadia fault system here is one of the most powerful in the world. And when it has earthquakes there, so you remember about a little 10 or 12 years ago, the earthquake out in Indonesia that killed about 250,000 people in there. That level earthquake is fairly common in geological time in this area as well. It's the same kind of fault system here. We have it. We know that the last major one is. I should have looked up the exact date. Pat, do you by chance remember the 16?
No, I think it's 1701.
1701. Yes, about a little over 300 years ago, there was a major earthquake here. We don't have any historical records from here, but the reason we know about it is because of Japan. Japan has kept historical records for many, many centuries of tsunamis. And in that particular earthquake, all of a sudden the tsunami came out of the middle. They didn't feel the earthquake because the earthquake happened over here. That tsunami was generated over here and traveled the whole length of the Pacific Ocean and wiped out several villages on the coast of Japan. We have the legends here that there was some indigenous groups in that same earthquake that they did were on the shore of Vancouver Island. They just simply disappeared at that point. We don't have the written records, we have the oral records on them. So we're able to begin to reconstruct this, and once geologists began to recognize this, then they could look for the evidence in the Puget Sound here, primarily in the form of the leftovers of tsunamis. So tsunamis are a big, big threat in the Pacific Northwest here, and these are all some of the different areas here in the Olympia, Seattle, Tacoma area, where we know we've had large, large tsunamis, earthquakes coming in from that area there. So Washington now is trying to be very progressive in taking, to do planning around this here. But it's a big challenge because oftentimes the areas that are geologically most hazardous are the places people want to live. They live with a nice view of the ocean, live on the coast there, live on the water, things like that. And we're not always aware of how vulnerable we are in that. I mentioned before that Mount Rainier is one of the most dangerous volcanoes here. One of the things that happens with volcanoes is when volcanoes erupt onto snow and ice, they set off a particular formation that's called a lahar. It's like a mud flow. The hot rock and ash melts the ice and it gets mixed together. And lahars can move well over 100 miles an hour. They're extremely fast moving, extremely destructive. They move down valleys. All right, and the yellow here shows the historic reach of lots of the lahars that have gone up of Mount Rainier. So the city of Puyallup, for example, and right on down to Tacoma actually sits on lahar deposits. And so even though Mount Rainier is quite a ways away, the reach of it through these areas, a lot of these downlake valleys, and of course people tend to settle in the valleys because that's where the rivers are, the streams and stuff are, but they become the channels for these volcanic eruptions. So again, people are trying to do more planning around this to prepare for this. If Mount Rainier were to erupt again, you'd need some warning system in place to be aware of the risk on that here. Climate is deeply affected by geology. We'll talk more about this tomorrow here, but we're moving into a hotter and drier period, and one of the effects of that is our forests are drying out, and so we're seeing more frequent and larger forest fires here, the Wolverine fire being the most recent one that affected us, burned up and basically around Holden. We were really, really fortunate that the people in the villages are kept it out of the village, but you can see the effects up on the peaks around here. Now, fire is a natural part of the ecosystems here. These are fire-adapted ecosystems, but we seem to be moving into a place where they're happening, because they're so hot and dry, they're happening more frequently and greater intensity, and they're now happening in places where people live. So we've got to be aware of that as well. But, we mentioned geology also brings tremendous blessings here. And one of the things I think, one of the reasons we love living in these places up in here is that mountains are natural water storage systems. The snow and the ice in them hold the water throughout the year and then let it out in gradual places there. And that makes possible, for example, our agriculture. That's a combination of water storage and irrigation. So this is diminishing with climate change. It's a real fear on that. But it has been a real source of a blessing for us to hold water and snow throughout the year and release it over slow times. Of course, many of us benefit from the hydroelectric power throughout the whole Pacific Northwest, and the dams and stuff in that area bring some other environmental challenges, but it's also been an enormous source of economic growth and stability up here. This is an area known as the Palouse. Anybody, incredibly rich, deep, fertile soil, so the whole wheat country based on that. What's the source of these soils? Yeah, these are wind-borne deposits from the glacial period here. When the glaciers came along, they grind up the rock into really, really fine kind of powder sort of that, and then the winds picked it up and just deposited in these enormously thick areas there, and now they make incredibly fertile soils. So these are, again, a geological origin on that. We have to treat these very carefully because they're a one-time source. They don't regenerate in place. These happen because of the continental glaciation created the conditions to create all this soil. Once it's eroded and gone, it's gone for good. But it's been an incredible blessing for us now. And then simply our recreation, our homes. Geology creates really beautiful places that people want to live. And so despite the hazards, we still choose to live here. So that's we're right at the end of our time. I'm happy to take questions for a few minutes. So people can also head up to lunch here. But that's our foundation of where we are. Yeah. That's a really good question. How accurate can volcanoes be? Increasingly more accurate. I don't think anybody read the news, but the last couple weeks there's been new earthquake swarms under Yellowstone. Yellowstone has a very big active magma chamber under there. The Yellowstone volcano is a particular kind of volcano. It doesn't erupt all that often, about every 500,000 years. It's a long time interval. But when it erupts, there are 10 and 12 foot ash deposits in Nebraska from the last volcanic eruption from Yellowstone. So the next time the Yellowstone volcano erupts, if it has a major eruption there, it will take much, of the state and everything around with it there. So, but increasingly we're able to map and monitor these magnitudes because as magma moves up, it sets off little earthquakes. And so we can actually track, as these earthquakes begin to move up there, we can see the magma's moving up. We don't have exact prediction, but the thing about Mount St. Helens, geologists predicted that relatively accurately. What's the one feature that eruption that the people didn't anticipate? Anybody remember this?
Lateral.
It erupted laterally. Everybody, they anticipated all, and most eruptions come up the top there. What happened in Mount St. Helens was the earthquakes actually set off a landslide on the side there that weakened that side, and so the lava came up and it will take the path of least resistance, which is usually up. This time it came and moves out. So it blasted laterally out the north side there. You remember Spirit Lake and all that. And so that was part of what was so destructive about the Mount St. Helens one. Yeah.
Does the same fault line go up into Alaska Airlines?
Yes, so north of where the subduction zone ends and becomes a fault again, it starts, it becomes what's called the Queen Charlotte Fault, falls all the way along British Columbia and on up into Alaska. And then when it turns the corner, it becomes a subduction zone again. So it's sliding along the Pacific coast. If you've taken the Alaska Ferry, all those beautiful islands out there, that's all that's faulting there. Once you get up towards Anchorage, it begins a subduction zone again. And so the Alaska Peninsula and the Aleutian Islands are all volcanoes. You may have been to Katmai, the Valley of 10,000 Smokes. Those are all volcanoes again, and some of the world's most active volcanoes from subduction zones. Yeah, Charlotte.
So what's happening with Mount Rainier?
So Mount Rainier is currently in a fairly dormant phase. Interesting thing about it, if you notice the profile of Mount Rainier, geologists speculate it used to be about 2,000 feet higher. That is, Mount Rainier was probably over 16,000 feet at one point. You look at the top, and it has actually kind of a jagged, broken top on that, because a lot like Mount St. Helens, it blew its top off at a certain point there. Let's see if I got the picture. Yeah, there's, you can see Rainier here. So Rainier has kind of a dome shape on that, but it used to be much more like Mount Shasta going up into a top of a peak. So it's had some really violent eruptions there. But you can see that's the main reason Rainier is such a source. See all that ice, all those glaciers? When Rainier erupts, and it's not even so much the lava, it's the hot ash. The hot ash will fall on that, melt that, and then send off those really catastrophic mud flows. So it doesn't seem to be in the imminent, like we're not talking about next year or 5 or 10 years from now, but it likely, it's not dead. It's a sort of a sleeping and dormant volcano now. So it will erupt again, most likely there. Yeah?
So the North American plate is sliding over the Juan de Fuca plate, and that is smaller than the Pacific plate. Will it eventually come over North America?
Most likely it will.
Pacific plate, will that create a new hotspot, do you think?
So it won't create a new hotspot. What it'll likely do is, as it runs over there, I don't know if it's pretty far back, I probably won't do it. Well, actually here, yeah. So you've got, this is the subduction zone here. As it runs out, what's going to happen is the San Andreas Fault will start moving inland. And all of this area here will be on the extension of the San Andreas Fault, because what will have been subduction will now move to this place sliding past each other. So the volcanoes will disappear, and we'll get a big fault system here. If you think about if you've been to the Sierra Nevada mountains are all granite. They're all those granite. Those are the old magma chambers from when there was a subduction zone there. So you have to imagine there used to be another 10, 15, 20,000 feet of rock on top of what the Sierra Nevada are now, and those were all volcanoes. Those have eroded away. So what we're seeing in the Sierra Nevada now are the old magma chambers. The same thing will happen here. It's going to take a long time. We won't be around to witness it. But these volcanoes here all have magma chambers underneath them that are solidifying and forming granite. Eventually, the subduction zone will end. San Andreas will fall, will come along here. These mountains will continue to be uplifted. They'll continue eroding. So the volcanoes will erode away, and eventually all that granite will come up there like it is in the Sierra Nevada. At least, unless something changes dramatically. But that's the trend.
Two questions. What are they saying about Baker these days? Yeah. I remember when I was a kid and them always talking about Baker. And is Holden in a Lahar zone for a glacier?
Good question. Holden is not in the Lahar zone. Fortunately, if you've been to Cloudy Pass, we have a big ridge and things like that between us and glacier. We're definitely in a fallout zone. So when you see the reason, there would have been pumice covering all of this stuff from the glacier period. It's washed away from the rivers. The ice wakes us up on this big bench, so it hasn't eroded away the snow and ice on that. But so we definitely could be affected if there were a big eruption in Glacier Peak there, but probably not a Lahar. I haven't heard much about Baker, and that's partly just mostly because I teach theology now rather than geology, so I don't pay as much attention to it. But I don't think the conditions have changed. I think Baker still is a very dangerous volcano as well on that. Maybe a couple more questions and we'll let you for lunch. Let's just get these three questions here. Yeah.
What's understood about the underwater volcano activity?
Well, they're so interesting. One example of that is very interesting. If anybody's familiar with Iceland, Iceland is a place where the Mid-Atlantic Ridge actually is exposed above ocean level there. So though Iceland is a series of volcanoes, a volcanic island, and you've got that spreading center, but it actually is above sea level there. So there we see all the volcanoes. But the most places we don't see them. One of the really fascinating things is a totally different topic, different tangent, but those underwater volcanoes have a series of vents, and they extrude really mineral-rich waters as part of them there. And they find life forming there. Life that doesn't depend on sunlight. It's the only place on the planet. Almost every place else, life depends on green plants or things that capture the sunlight there. But they find all forms of life in these vents. And they're now speculating they may be the oldest sources of life on the planet here. Because we go back, this was a volcanic planet from the very beginning. The oceans seem to have formed within the first few hundred million years. And you would have had then constantly volcanic eruptions bringing these really mineral-rich things into the ocean waters there. That may well be where some of the earliest life evolved and then spread through the ocean and eventually onto the land there. But yeah, they're really, really fascinating places on that. There's a hand here, yeah.
So you talked briefly about climate change.
Yeah.
And also, apparently, there's a huge gradual movement toward warming. And so are you saying that, especially, there's a lot of concern about human impact on global climate change. So are you saying that there's already kind of a trend that way, but the human activity is accelerating that?
I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow, because my whole talk tomorrow is on climate change and things like that, so I'll go into more detail. But the interesting thing right now is that climate change may have natural cycles may have actually slowed some of our climate change we're experiencing right now. I'm pretty well convinced that the vast majority of climate change experience in terms of warming is human caused. We're in a natural kind of cooling trend. Pat and I were just at a presentation a couple weeks ago of a lot of the scientists who are working on this here, and they were talking about between 1.5 and 2% of the current the warming we're seeing could have natural causes. The vast majority seems human causes. But we're actually in a period, we're in this interglacial period, but it's been more of a cooling trend. So it may actually be softening a little bit of that. If we come out of that cooling trend and we add human warming on that, we could see a real acceleration. So that's a real danger in that area there. There was another hand here, yeah.
I grew up in Decorah, but now I live in Texas. And North Texas and Oklahoma is having earthquakes where they weren't before. And now the theory is that it's man-made earthquakes. How do you feel about that?
So that in the North Dakota, this would be a good place to stop in terms of both geological blessings and geological hazards, because sometimes they come together on that. What's happening in Oklahoma and North Texas is there's a new technology called hydraulic fracturing, or we sometimes call it fracking. And there's a lot of stored natural gas in rocks that is inaccessible to traditional drilling and mining. But what happens now is you can actually drill down into these units there and then drill horizontally. So they're able to drill horizontally there. What they do is they put a lot of high-pressure solutions down there, and they set up explosions. And those high-pressure forces that are then forced into the fractured rock there, and it drives the gas out there. But when you put rocks that are under pressure there, I mean, think about this here. When you've got a squeaky wheel, what do you put on that wheel? Well, you put a lubricant on there, right? Take it away from that. You put your oil. Now you've got all these fractured rocks under pressure, and we're putting lubricants, we're forcing lubricants down there, which is these pressure there, and that sets off earthquakes. So we are triggering lots and lots of earthquakes. Now, the good news is most of them are relatively small, but cumulatively, they can be quite damaging, and we don't know. One of the irony, this again, it's a whole different geology lecture here, but anybody know what the largest recorded earthquake in North America in the last few hundred years, where it was?
Missouri.
In Missouri, right? In exactly the last place that you would think it would be. It was in right the center part of the continent, a place, you know, that hasn't had a whole lot of geological activity for hundreds of millions of years. But there are old, Missouri has an old suture zone. It has a place where these continents came together. They're pretty well, you know, stitched together pretty well, but there's fractures there still. And eventually, over time, those build up. One of the reasons why that earthquake in Missouri was so widespread felt is because the rocks are much older, they're much colder, they're much more rigid, and when you hit a rock like that, an earthquake there, it gets transmitted much, much farther. So that Missouri earthquake set off bells ringing in Boston. They felt it in Boston.
Wow.
You know, we get a lot more earthquakes on the West Coast, but our rocks are really fractured. They're much warmer. So the earthquakes don't travel as far. It's sort of like, you know, like trying to put a movement in the sandbox. You know, you feel it locally, but it doesn't travel very far. When they happen in the mid part of the country there, they can really be big and they're going to go a long way. And that's part of the concern about Oklahoma in particular, is that it's not far at all from this major fault system in the Missouri area there. And we could unintentionally trigger some stuff on that. Yeah. Geological blessing, we get the fruits of that good thing. Geological hazard, we add it to climate change, we set up earthquakes. Thanks very much, folks. Tomorrow.